Hey everyone, and welcome to At the Letters. Ben Nicholson Smith here, Arden Swelling alongside me on ATL. Christian Ryan producing behind the scenes along with Nick Andrade. And thanks to you for listening to At the Letters. And Arden, we've honestly got a ton to get to today. I mean, I think that the series between the Yankees and the Blue Jays, which is still unfolding as we record this on Thursday, May 18th, it's probably been one of the most entertaining of the year. So we're going to get into Eyegate. We're going to get into Aaron Judge stealing signs or third base coach placement, Domingo Herman sticky stuff. And then there's actual baseball stuff too, with Vlad Jr. Currently battling a knee issue, Alek Manoah not performing well. And we'll go behind the scenes a little bit as well. So a lot to get to. I think to start, obviously, we're going to start Yankees and Jays here. And like I said, to me, this has got to be, in my opinion, probably the most entertaining series of the year so far. Is that fair to say at this point?
Yeah, for, maybe Leafs fans who haven't been paying that much attention to the Jays and now suddenly are paying a lot more attention to them. Not every series has been like this. It's been sort of perfectly timed that the first series, a lot of people have been like, oh, okay, what's going on with the Jays, has been this Shakespearean, theatrical, dramatic, heavyweight fight between two teams that really don't seem to like each other and has really honestly been like the talk of baseball. Like, it's not just here in Toronto, but it's globally across MLB. All eyes have been on this series.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, this is a couple of teams that even going into this series, they did not like each other. I mean, we've said it on ATL a few times, but Vlad Guerrero Jr., the Yankees are his least favorite team. He says he would not play for them, not even dead. And he's serious about that. We know Alek Manoah and Gerrit Cole do not get along. There is a rivalry here that even someone as mild-mannered as Kevin Gausman is like, yeah, we kind of dislike each other a little bit. That's becoming more and more apparent, and probably would have been the case even if there weren't any questions about sign stealing. But I think we need to start there just as far as the whole series and the whole drama between these two teams, because that's where things really kicked off at the beginning of the week when it came to Aaron Judge moving his eyes around, clearly looking somewhere for some sort of help.
All right, Buck, so you and I looked at each other at the same moment right when we saw this three pitches ago.
Watch what he's looking at.
Yeah. What is that?
Where's he looking?
Where's he looking? And he did it more than once.
Yeah. It's really, really unusual.
We've since learned a ton about that. And so I think that we're now much better equipped to put that in context with respect to what was actually happening. So I guess knowing what we do now, Arden, like, where do you land on that specific element? The Aaron Judge, the eyes, what was happening there between the Yankees and the Blue Jays, and relaying, it seems, some signs.
Well, first of all, just as an aside, like the Vladdy, I would never play for them, not even dead thing, goes into my long list of quotes that people remember that actually don't really make sense. Add it to the Alek Manoah, pressure is something you put in your tires. Now, pressure isn't something you put in oxygen is something that you put in your tires. Pressure is a measure of that in the tires. Vladdy, I wouldn't play for the Yankees, not even dead. You're not playing for anyone if you're dead, because you're dead.
True.
You're over. You have ceased consciousness and the ability to play baseball. So add that to the long list of quotes that don't make sense. I'll let you respond before I get back to things that actually matter.
Yes. Only in some sort of alternate zombie universe would Vlad Jr. be playing for anyone dead. So technically speaking, that is impossible.
Back to what's going on the field. Look, I'm not buying what Aaron Judge was saying. He was looking over at the dugout because they were chirping. And in my opinion, Aaron Judge was being relayed information about either what pitch was coming or what the location of that pitch might be, or both via his first base coach. Do you see it any other way?
Judge was lying 100%. I was in the clubhouse after the game on Monday and I asked Judge and he lied. And that's okay. I mean, players lie, GMs lie. It's part of the game. But yeah, he was lying. He was not telling his teammates to be quiet. He was getting information from them. And look, I would not expect him to be honest and say, oh yeah, you know what? I was actually getting some signs because the Blue Jays were being really sloppy and they were giving up information. And so I was taking advantage of that. So yeah, I have no problem with it, but he was lying.
I think it's important to remember that this is very commonplace in the game. Every time you watch a game across MLB, there is information being lifted and communicated to hitters. You just don't always pick up on it. Not every broadcast does as good of a job as ours did, by the way. Like, massive credit to everybody on the Sportsnet broadcast who noticed that in real time and then presented it in a way that this became the topic that all of baseball was talking about. Like, not only Dan Schulman and Buck Martinez, who did like such an elite job of communicating that to fans and talking through that in a very like objective and excellent way, but also people behind the scenes like Doug Walton, who would have been producing that, Troy Clara, who's the director, the people who are cutting the replays. Like, the way that they did that in real time very quickly was exceptional. It was such good work by our broadcast crew. But yeah, you're not noticing this stuff usually. It's just happening in the background. Think about how much stuff happens in a baseball game the cameras don't pick up. There's a lot of it. You're not always seeing the banter between dugouts. You're not always seeing John Schneider like directing barbs at the opposition's dugout, because cameras aren't always trained on this stuff. But believe me, signs are being stolen, tendencies are being read at all times across every MLB game played this year. Every well-run organization, the Blue Jays included, employs advanced scouts who crush video looking for pitch tips. Some organizations have like one guy working on this or one woman working on this. Some organizations have literal departments, multiple headcount of people working on tips of their opponents upcoming. Really, as an organization in MLB, if you aren't employing these measures and tactics right now, you aren't doing everything you possibly can to win.
Exactly. And this is, there's like a little cottage industry of this, and it's got to be the coolest job to be a hired gun on this front. But there are people out there who are exceptionally good at picking up these little things. And they are little things. Like Jay Jackson, he has since admitted to Ken Rosenthal he was tipping. If you look at the video, you can kind of see he was holding the ball in such a way that the first base coach of the Yankees would have been able to see it. But I'm watching that game, certainly not, you know, obvious to me that he's tipping. I think to 90% of even uniform personnel, it's not obvious, but some people are really good at this. Cito Gaston, when he was with the Blue Jays, had a reputation of being elite at this. Some people are hired, paid very handsomely for their ability to do this. Others are maybe, you know, crushing video. Maybe it's their first job in baseball and they're just pouring through it and trying to figure out any sort of tell. But these things are really significant, because if you have Jay Jackson, who's the eighth reliever on the Blue Jays at that point, facing Aaron Judge, the single season home run leader in the American League history, like, any advantage that Aaron Judge can get in that situation is going to tilt the scales in the favor of the Yankees.
And this is the Yankees. So if they had something on Jay Jackson, the last guy in the Blue Jays bullpen, imagine what they had on the guys who they face in leverage, right? Like, imagine what they have on Jordan Romano and Eric Swanson. Imagine what they have on Jose Berríos and on Kevin Gausman. Like, oh, by the way, have you ever wondered why Jose Berríos at times pitches with a mouth guard? It's not performance based. It's because earlier in his career, he was tipping with his mouth. So he pitches with a mouth guard so that he clenches it so that he doesn't give away what pitch is coming by either mouth open, breaking ball, mouth closed, fastball. Have you ever wondered why Kevin Gausman uses the largest glove you're ever going to see a pitcher using in baseball? Look at his glove next time that he's pitching. It's massive, because earlier in his career, like, he was manipulating pitches with a smaller glove and teams were able to tell whether fastball or splitter was coming. Berríos at times just last season was tipping and teams figured it out. There's belief with the Blue Jays that Gausman was tipping just last season. It is certainly strange how certain clubs have teed off on him for like 8 runs in an inning at times. So like, this is stuff that is a constant project throughout the season for like analysts and researchers within front offices. Like, R&D personnel are constantly looking at not only external tips but internal tips as well, to see what are we doing, what tendencies do we have that could be picked up on via the opposition. Let's iron that out before it's too late.
Exactly. And that's some of where those resources go, is sometimes you'll get like a hired gun, an outside consultant, to look at your own business to make sure that it's clean. And honestly, that's on the Blue Jays. They need to be the ones who are cleaning this up. And initially, you know, of course, there's this question, are the Yankees doing things in ways that are breaking the rules? You know, I understand there's some concern over the third base coach placement. We'll get into that. But at the same time, Jay Jackson, that's on him. Alejandro Kirk, the way he's setting up behind the plate, he's setting up really early at times. He's setting up really open. That's on him. And the Blue Jays can be mad that Aaron Judge was able to get some extra information there. But as long as it wasn't done with electronic signs, which is a presumption because the Yankees did use electronic signs and did break MLB's rules in 2015 and 16, violations for which they were fined $100,000. But as long as they were not doing that this time, that's on the Jays, and that's good for the Yankees, and that's on the Blue Jays to clean up with Kirk and with Jackson and with others.
100%. The Blue Jays have to be better at this going forward because it's not the first time it's been an issue for them. Like, pitchers have to be consistent in their deliveries. Like, you don't want to have different timings for different pitches, different setups for different pitches, the ways you manipulate the ball in your glove. Like, you know, Jay Jackson, a good example. You got to keep that glove tight to your body. You want to keep it closed when you're manipulating the ball. Catcher setup is huge. To your point, the Blue Jays have had this issue in the past with their catchers having tendencies that have been tipping pitches or locations. Like, the Blue Jays have worked with both of their current catchers on these specific things. It was an issue in the wild card series last year against Seattle. And there have been times, like, for both Danny Jansen and Alejandro Kirk, honestly, when their setups, whether it's, as you said, Kirk setting up too early on either side of the plate. Well, if you're Aaron Judge and you know how the Blue Jays are going to pitch you, if the catcher is set up to the outside, it's probably going to be a breaking ball. And if the catcher is set up to the inside, pretty likely that's going to be a fastball. When you're dealing with relievers who only throw fastballs and breaking balls, two pitch guys, you can pretty easily figure out what you're about to get and hit a ball 470 feet. By the way, like, total credit to Aaron Judge that, like, even if he knows what's coming or doesn't, is still just crushing balls into the, like, straightaway dead center into the flight deck. The way that he's hitting baseballs, he is just a next level exceptional hitter.
He couldn't see the catcher with the way he was looking right there.
Yeah, just did it again. And he pummeled it. He hit it a country mile for his second home run of the night.
But even with, like, catchers, it can be when you set up too wide. Now all of a sudden you kind of know, well, there's probably going to be something down, like a breaking pitch down the zone, because as a catcher, you're anticipating blocking that pitch in the dirt. If you set up narrow with your feet closer together, well, now all of a sudden it's okay, you're elevating something and you're probably elevating a heater because you're setting up to be able to get up high to receive it. So, like, teams are going to figure out little things like this, especially teams like the Yankees, who have long led the league in sheer headcount in their analytics department, in, like, their R&D department. I mean, this is something that the Yankees have been investing heavily in for well over a decade now. They've been ahead of the league on it. And all those analysts and programmers, advanced scouts, like, they aren't only working on pitch design. As you said, they are crushing video and they are looking for advantages that they can deploy in games. And the Yankees have a very well-tuned process for how that information gets to their players, their coaches, and then how it is utilized in game in a way that is not easily perceptible.
And to your point, Danny Jansen in 2021 against Houston, he was setting up super early. And this is something that Joe Siddle caught on the broadcast at the time. And it was pretty obvious once you started seeing the video with that in mind that Jansen was basically giving away location. And as you said, with location, you can get a pretty good hint as to what the pitch call might be. So that's something they cleaned up. Now it's something they have to clean up with Kirk. Those adjustments are doable, but that's ultimately on the Jays.
Like, you need to clean this up now because it's easy to be behind on this stuff. And this is the Yankees in May against Jay Jackson, like the eighth reliever in the Blue Jays bullpen. The teams you're going to see in October in the postseason, not only the Yankees, Houston, Tampa Bay, if you get to a World Series, the Dodgers, those teams are all elite at picking up tendencies and exploiting them. And in October, when they're preparing for a series, when they're not just, like, advanced scouting for 3 days in Toronto in May, but they're advanced scouting for a literal postseason series. I mean, the level of granularity and detail that they will go into poring over these 6 months of video that they have of your tendencies, the slightest tell is going to get picked up and exploited. And if you haven't ironed that out by September, October, you're going to be far too late to get ahead of it.
Well, and think about this, you know, you mentioned Kevin Gausman a couple minutes ago, and where were his really bad starts this year? Oh yeah, one was in Houston, the other one was against the team managed by Alex Cora. Like, okay, interesting. It just interesting. I guess I am implying something. I don't really know. That's pure speculation when I say that. But yeah, you need to be careful with this stuff. I guess the next part of it that this leads to, and this is where it starts veering into like some really absurd territory, and I find it quite entertaining. I don't think I would want to talk about third base coaching boxes for more than like a day and a half. I have never spent so much time in my life looking at third base coaching boxes as I had on Tuesday evening at Rogers Center. I don't want that to become the new way I watch baseball, but for 2 days, it was pretty interesting. And I guess, like, where do you land on that whole thing, the back and forth between the Yankees and the Jays and third base coaching positioning boxes?
It's not about the boxes, and it's not about, like, where Luis Rojas is standing, because, like, you watch as much baseball as I do. There's never is the coach in the box. Very, very seldom is the coach in any game in this league actually in the box. And look, if you're standing that close to Aaron Judge, who's hitting like 118 mile per hour missiles around the yard, yeah, I might want to back up a little bit too and give myself a chance. I understand that. But I think the Blue Jays kind of raising a stink about, you know, whether or not coaches are in the box is really just putting the league and MLB itself just on notice to what the Yankees are doing. And it's just, and not that they aren't aware, but I think it is just like making it more of a topic and just making it just kind of raising that awareness of it a little bit to the point where teams can now be a bit more diligent and run better countermeasures. I think like the hope is that just by saying like, hey, the Yankees are doing this against the eighth best reliever in our bullpen in a 6-0 game, I think the hope is that teams now will be much more vigilant and that will make it more difficult for the Yankees to win in the future, more difficult for them to use this stuff to their advantage in the future. Like, I think that's what it's about telling other teams, hey, be careful when you're playing the Yankees. Cause like it honestly, it's not about the boxes. No. I think it's about making it harder for the Yankees to win in the future.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's because, okay, like he's got a bit of a different angle. Like, I guess I understand if a coach is positioned far enough back, they can see the grip of the pitcher. Okay, but ultimately, that's going to cut both ways, whatever it is. You do want your third base coaches to be safe. It's not a nothing concern. To me, I found it entertaining because it's so different. It's so out there. I don't know.
Do you agree with my theory, though? Yes. That's why the Yankees are raising it? Or sorry, why the Blue Jays are raising it?
And I agree with the theory. And I agree that it's good. You want to set off alarm bells because you want whoever's facing the Yankees next, in the next 2-3 weeks, you want them to be on alert because you want the Yankees to lose games if you're the Blue Jays. So anything you can do to help the Yankees lose games, make their life more difficult, you make sure that their manager, Aaron Boone, is stressing about this instead of stressing about matchups or you know, doing something else. That's kind of good gamesmanship to be able to do that. Now, do I think that they could have done it in another way just by saying, we think that they were relaying signs. We think that they were picking up signs and relaying them. And we know that they were nabbed by the commissioner's office a few years ago. And we're going to be very careful with this team because we don't trust them. I think that would have sent the same message. I don't think the third base coaching box stuff necessarily accomplished anything that you couldn't have done in a different way. But at the same time, I found it entertaining. And I don't think that there's anything too problematic about the third base coach stuff. I just don't think it solved anything.
I think they've said that without saying it explicitly, though, right? There's subtext to it that's pretty clear, no?
For sure. And I think they could have come out and been a bit more direct.
Do you get the sense that the coaches of these two teams actually might dislike each other more than the players on these two teams, right? Like, do you think that Kevin Gausman or Chris Bassett like really know the first thing about Oswaldo Cabrera or like harbor some sort of grudge against Clark Schmidt, you know, Wandy Peralta? But it does, like I really don't think there's that much detest between the players, maybe like a couple of particulars, but I think that honestly, it's the coaching staffs that really don't like each other between these two teams.
Yeah, I think broadly speaking, it's more so the coaching staffs. Like, for example, don't think the Blue Jays love Brad Wilkerson. Gonna go out there and say that. Don't think Luis Rojas loves the Toronto Blue Jays. Don't think Pete Walker is a particular fan of the New York Yankees, based on what we're seeing. Now, again, we're watching this. This is heated moments. It's baseball, and this stuff can be kind of forgotten within a few months, but it can also gain momentum. And I think there are players, like, I think Alek Manoah truly is not like the biggest. Garrett Cole, Alek Manoah, there's something there. Vlad Jr., yeah, he dislikes the Yankees. Aaron Judge at this point, I don't know what he thinks about the Blue Jays, but I doubt Toronto is his favorite place to play at this point in time. So I think there are little pockets, but I agree. I think for the most part, it's actually the coaches who are most fixated on this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the way he's hitting, I think he should like playing here. But I don't think that, Harrison Bader really dislikes Bo Bichette, as far as I know, right? Or that Gleyber Torres has a huge grudge against Alejandro Kirk. It does feel like at some point something's going to happen where these teams are out of their dugouts and there's an on-field confrontation. Maybe not, but it does kind of feel like at some point something like that is brewing. And I do wonder if in that moment it's actually the coaches going back and forth with each other more than the players. I wonder if it's actually the players playing peacekeeper in those moments. And it's like you said, it's like Guillermo Martinez going after Brad Wilkerson, or Pete Walker and Aaron Boone going at it. I do wonder if there's more of that from the coaches, which is actually kind of interesting now, thinking that lifetime Yankee Don Mattingly is in a Jays hoodie in that situation. But I do wonder if that's how that would play out.
Mattingly would be playing peacekeeper, I think, safe to say, along with a few others. The only thing Kevin Gausman knows about Anthony Volpe is he can't hit a splitter. He's not, he's not sitting there, having nightmares about these players, I don't think. Honestly, I think you're probably right. And it might be, Aaron Judge holding back Brad Wilkerson and Bo Bichette trying to calm tempers. So we'll see. Hopefully cooler heads prevail. Hopefully no one escalates this to a point where, anyone's safety is compromised, obviously. To this point, honestly, I find it really, really entertaining. I think it's been pretty compelling. It's different. So it's been fun from that standpoint.
What'd you make of Domingo Germán, who was literally cheating in this series?
And this is the thing, right? So there's the allegations, and I think it's pretty safe to say the Yankees likely had something and were likely able to relay that to their hitters. It wasn't just Judge, it was also Jake Bowers. But that's part of the game. That's part of the game. So we accept that. Now you get to Domingo Germán. That's cheating. It's not allowed. If you put sticky stuff on your hand and James Hoy, the home plate umpire, said he had never felt a stickier hand in his life, then you are going to have an advantage. This is documented that Driveline and all kinds of other places. You put sticky stuff on your hand, you're going to have better spin rates. You're going to have just better stuff. So that's cheating. Domingo Germán was cheating. That helped the Yankees win a close game against the Blue Jays. They cheated to do it. Those are just facts.
It was interesting that the Yankees didn't really explicitly deny it, right? Aaron Boone comes out and says, Domingo put us in a bad position. He went over the line. We've had a conversation with him about it. These are all just essentially admissions of guilt in a backwards way. Nobody's come out and said, he was wronged. He wasn't doing that. They've got it wrong, right? So I think that's also part of some of the animosity between these two teams, is that there's just a real brazenness to the way that the Yankees are going about some of this stuff. As I mentioned, stealing signs in a 6-0 game against the journeyman, 8th best reliever on the Blue Jays, right? Domingo Germán with crap all over his hand and his pants, and using, as you said, as an umpire who literally feels pitchers' hands every single day. Yeah.
He's felt a few hands in his day.
The stickiest that I have ever felt. There is just a brazenness to how openly the Yankees are deploying some of these tactics, and I've got all kinds of thoughts on the sort of sticky stuff thing, but I do think that plays into this as well, into this animosity. It's just how brazen the Yankees have been.
I got one more thought here before we move on to some actual baseball, like Vlad Jr. and Alek Manoah. And, you know, because there's, I've heard a school of thought that, like, around Jay Jackson, you know, oh, the Yankees, like, can't believe they'd be doing this to a guy. Like, he's barely in the major leagues, hanging on by the skin of his teeth. It's a 6-0 game. To me, it's the major leagues. You could be down 12-0. It could be a guy who's 20 years old making his major league debut. You're in the major leagues. You got to play by against the best competition. And that includes some relaying of signs sometimes. So I don't buy that at all. I think that 6-0, 12-0, you got to beat the best.
No, there's no there's no friends out there, right? This, you know, despite the fact that Jay Jackson will make a friggin' shred of what Aaron Judge will in Aaron Judge's
doesn't
career,
matter.
Like, it doesn't matter, right? And that's why Aaron Judge is gonna make hundreds of millions of dollars in his career, yep, because he like exploits every last advantage that he can to be the best player possible. Like, that's why, like, because at the end of his career, we're all gonna look back and look at his total home run total, which will be one higher because of the one that he hit off of Jay Jackson, and say, wow, what a great, phenomenal player, possibly a Hall of Famer. Look at how many home runs this guy has in total. We're not going to say, oh, well, let's shave one off because, you know, he knew what was coming that one time, right? So, like, nobody's going to remember this at the end of Aaron Judge's career. So, like, no, I totally agree with you. I understand why the Blue Jays would be aggrieved at it, but I agree with you that, like, it's the major leagues. Like, it's cutthroat. It's cutthroat in front offices too, right? Like, it's cutthroat in the way that especially the Yankees like operate. There's no friends. There's no like ethics, honestly. No. It's win at all costs.
You think that Andrew Friedman, you know, the first time he's making a trade with a rookie GM is going to go easy on the rookie GM?
Yeah.
No, like he's going to try to fleece the GM.
Absolutely. As it pertains to the sticky stuff, like I need there to be some sort of empirical measure of this. Like, I need there to be some sort of standard apply, something like evidentiary, other than just arbitrarily an umpire saying that's the stickiest I've ever felt. Like, okay, but like, where is the line of sticky? Like, that means by saying that, that you have felt plenty of hands that have been sticky and you have allowed the pitcher to continue pitching with that sticky hand. So it's like, where is the line, right? Like, I just need there to be some sort of standard for what's too sticky and what isn't. Because what we're doing right now, essentially, with these hand checks is it's like a police officer trying to tell if a driver's over the alcohol limit by smelling their breath, right? It's just completely arbitrary. You're not using a breathalyzer. You're not using a machine that says, oh, that's over 0.08. He's just smelling the breath and being like, yeah, I feel like that's probably too much. Oh, yeah, no, that's on the right side of it. What's the standard here? Like, I don't really agree with the way that baseball is doing this. I don't have the answer. Like, I don't know if there's a test, like test strip or something you could rub on a guy's hand. And
if it stays on, he has to go out of the game.
Or turn a certain color or something. I don't know if you could monitor the spin rates in a game and be like, hey, this guy's spin rates are X deviations above where they normally are.
But what if he's always cheating?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
right? Yeah, I don't know if you can measure guys in spring training with nothing on their hands and be like, this is your standard spin rate, right? I don't know. I don't have the answers. One answer I do have, honestly, is that there should be some sort of like collectively agreed upon adhesive substance that pitchers can use that is just on the mound. And maybe that's called rosin. I don't know. But like, maybe there should be like something that we allow, because I think there are a lot of hitters that would like pitchers to have good command of their pitches and be able to grip the ball and locate them well so that hitters aren't like bailing out all the time. I just think that hitters don't want it to be, you know, the spider tack stuff that Mitchell Hooper uses to like lift Atlas stones at World's Strongest Man. Like, I think that there has to be something acceptable that lets pitchers grip, control, and command their pitches without making them these like nuclear weapon pitches of mass destruction that they're cooking up in driveline laps.
For sure. All right. Well, as we await a better system for MLB, we will take a quick break and then come back and discuss Vlad Jr., Alek Manoah, and more with respect to these Blue Jays. Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Thank you.
Welcome back to At the Letters. Arden, a couple nights ago, Vlad Jr. was due up fourth in the ninth inning. And we know what he thinks about the New York Yankees. And that was a very close game. And yet he was removed from the game at that point with right knee discomfort. The next day, he was seen in the dugout with some batting gloves on, kind of mulling around as though he might pinch hit. He did not pinch hit. That was a game the Blue Jays won anyway, thanks to Danny Jansen. But right knee discomfort for Vlad Guerrero Jr., this is not good for the Blue Jays as they try to get one of their most important players back to full health. What do you make of this situation right now?
I think it's a little wear and tear issue for Vlad, and we've seen these accumulating with him this year. There was a knee issue in spring training, right, on a pretty innocuous-looking base-running play. That held him out for nearly 2 weeks. There was a wrist issue in Pittsburgh, which is something that he's battled off and on throughout his career. Here's another knee issue here right now. Wouldn't be the first one he's grinded through throughout his career. So like, it's something to monitor, but I think this is just part of the deal when you play as much as Vlad does, right? You look back at the game logs and it's like 2020, 60 games. 2021, 161 games. 2022, 160 games. This guy plays every day. Since the beginning of 2020, only Dansby Swanson and Freddie Freeman have played more games. Only Marcus Semien and Freeman have more plate appearances. So Vlad has played a ton of baseball over the last few years, and that means he's not always going to feel his best, and stuff is going to hurt a lot of the time, and sometimes that's going to hold him out of lineups.
Yeah, and it's a rarity because, like you said, he posts up, so most of the time he is in there. We will see if he's in there on Thursday. But as you pointed out with those games totals, we have not seen a real extended absence from Vlad Jr. in the last few years. And for a moment there, you know, he's here, he's going for an MRI. You just kind of wondered if there was something that was going to keep him out for weeks rather than days. It seems now that the Blue Jays are hopeful that it can be days and then he can be back in there. But, you know, needless to say, his bat and his glove and his base running, you know, despite making a pretty significant base running blunder on Sunday, he is a good base runner. He is a very good fielder. He's just so, so important to this team.
And he plays so hard all the time. There's the occasional ball that maybe he doesn't hustle on, and he does actually like get dinged for that from time to time. And yeah, ideally you would have none of those in your game. But when you're talking about Vladimir Guerrero Jr., as you said, a guy who posts, who plays every single day, and who the vast majority of the time when he's going first to third or second to home or stretching a double, like, is giving absolute full effort, is playing with a ton of energy and a ton of exertion. And it's not even like his games played totals are inflated by, you know, pure DH days. Like, Vlad gets the occasional one, but he's also played the 34th most defensive innings in MLB since the beginning of 2020. So this guy's been on his feet in the field a lot, not playing the most demanding position, but like, just that volume, that workload accumulates, as does swinging a bat as hard as he does. This guy is like maximal force and torque at the plate. That's how you hit a ball 117 miles per hour. Some very explosive and stressful movements. And meanwhile, you're fouling balls off your knees and your shins and your feet, and you're getting hit by pitches, and you're jamming your fingers and your wrists on awkward foul balls, or when you're sliding into bases, you're rolling your ankles, running around, like all these little things accumulate. So something to manage going forward, but probably not the last sort of nagging wear and tear injury Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is going to deal with.
He's just so fun to watch. You know, you think about the max effort throws where he's throwing like 90 miles an hour across the diamond, the max effort base running where he's like belly flopping into second base.
Vladimir Guerrero Jr. rips one to right center, and that ball is down. Harris will cut it off just shy of the wall. Head first slide into second by Vladdy.
He is such a fun player to watch every single day. So hopefully for the sake of our entertainment, he's out there. We will see. And, you know, it's for the Jays, this is actually, you know, it's obviously significant. He's one of the best players in baseball. But it's also not a great time for their depth to be tested anywhere with respect to their starting position players, because their bench has been quite bad. to this point in the season. It is not good. Kevin Biggio having a very rough start. Santiago Espinal, a very rough start. The catchers, Danny Jansen, yes, 2 walk-off hits in 4 days, still off to a slow start offensively. Alejandro Kirk, same thing. So it is, you know, with respect to this bench as a whole, this is starting to become, and what's done is done. It doesn't mean that these guys are going to struggle moving forward. They may all bounce back. Certainly their track records would suggest that's possible. But to this point, it has been a very rough go for the Blue Jays bench.
Yeah, I thought that the Blue Jays bench would be better than it's been to this point. There's still some time, and it's like, it's one of those funny things where I feel like with the benefit of regular playing time, like you might actually see a Santiago Espinal come out of it or a Kevin Biggio come out of it. They just don't get that many opportunities. Like the Blue Jays have essentially, like, and like I'm including Vlad in this right now, even though he's not playing every day, like they have essentially like 6 everyday players: Springer, Bo, Vlad, Varsho, Chapman, Whit Merrifield. Those guys play every day.
Kiermaier?
Not every day, but he's close, right? There's like a second tier with Kiermaier and Belt, where it's like these guys are probably like 4 out of 5 or, you know, 4 out of 6, somewhere in there. And then you've got one of Jansen / Kirk, although like those guys do get their DH days here and there. And then it's Espinal, Biggio, Lucas, who really just aren't playing at all. Right. Yep. Lucas, like, not playing at all. And Espinal, Biggio playing extremely infrequently. And it's really hard to feel your best at the plate and to find something at the plate when you're not playing that frequently. And the thing is, like, you look down at AAA and it's, oh, well, would Otto Lopez be a better fit? Or would, like, Ernie Clements on the heater of all heaters, like, bring him up? You bring one of those guys up, they're not going to play either. Because just like the way the Blue Jays roster is constructed, like the playing time isn't going to be there for Ernie Clement to keep hitting 500 over 10 games or whatever he's doing. Literally, I think it actually is 500 over 10 games. Like the guy is so, so red hot. But there's just that opportunity wouldn't be there at the big league level without somebody like a Vlad or a Bo or a Chapman going on the IL. And the Blue Jays obviously aren't hoping for that.
And you look at Biggio and Espinal, they have OPSs in the 4s in the major leagues. Not good. Now, Otto Lopez has an OPS starting in the 4s in AAA. So, yeah, he's not going to be the answer. I want to ask you about Biggio, though, because, okay, you look at his walk total, and the last time he drew a walk was April 3rd. We're recording this on May 18th. And he hasn't played every day, but this is Kevin Biggio we're talking about. It's been weird. And it's a topic that I think a lot of fans, you know, have some opinions about. To me, it comes down to, is there someone better? Otherwise, you know, if there's no one better, then there's no discussion to be had. If there is someone better, then maybe there's a discussion to be had. But where do you land on Biggio? You know, we know his OBP has historically been much better. I'm sure the projections would forecast an improved on-base percentage. But you look at the at-bats, and pitchers are getting ahead of Biggio, and they're not really allowing him to flex his great skill, which is his plate discipline.
I think the Blue Jays would like to see him a bit more aggressive in 2-strike counts with pitches right on the edge of the strike zone, instead of taking it and like hoping that he gets that ball call. And he's often right, honestly, with pitches that are just off the plate, but he doesn't get those calls very often. Like the Blue Jays would rather he be aggressive and put those balls in play. That's one adjustment I think that he could make. But honestly, like, he's just not playing that much. The Blue Jays have played 15 games this month. Kevin Biggio has 17 plate appearances. So I'm not really like looking at him as, oh, the Blue Jays need more from Kevin Biggio. The guy's got 17 plate appearances this month. The guy barely plays. Like, I'm looking more at Alejandro Kirk, who is running like a massive ground ball rate this year, like up over, I was pulling it earlier today, it's like up near 65% this month or over his last 21. It's the like highest, I pulled the rolling ground ball rate graph for the broadcast. It's like the highest 21 game stretch of his career in terms of ground ball rate. It's like up right around 65%. And just like talking to some Blue Jays hitting coaches recently, like there have been some things in his swing that they've been trying to iron out and they have not been taking. Like it sounds like he's been flying open in his swing with his front shoulder, which is really causing him to roll over pitches. So the Blue Jays have been like working on that, staying closed, trying to keep his load back on his back leg to just encourage him to keep that left shoulder closed. But it really like hasn't taken. So when he's sort of swinging at pitches that are like down and in on the inside half, he's rolling over them. Or when, you know, if he gets those breaking balls down in the way, same thing. He's flying open. He's rolling over them. So I think the Blue Jays would like to see him get back to staying closed and driving balls to right center. But we really haven't seen that. You look at two hits on Wednesday night, one of them off Gerrit Cole. That's encouraging. But the double off Gerrit Cole was extremely softly struck. It was like 77 miles per hour. So he's still not making great contact.
Well, exactly. And the swing does not look quite as dynamic, quite as powerful. You wonder, is the bat speed fully there? You know, this is, as you say, that is a bigger question, a more important question for the Jays. Now, he's 24 years old. This is a guy who hit 14 homers with a great on-base percentage last year. Typically, the skills that allow a player to do that do not disappear at age 25. So I think that medium term, there should be optimism for Alejandro Kirk. But, you know, we'll see. They could use that production now, especially if Vlad Jr. is on the bench periodically as he recovers from this knee issue.
The one thing I wonder about Alejandro Kirk that he may want to do differently going forward, he also may not want to do this because it might be part and parcel to his approach, but he may want to be more aggressive on the first pitch of plate appearances. So the double off Cole, that was the first pitch of the plate appearance. Alejandro Kirk got a strike there, and that shouldn't be surprising because Alejandro Kirk's first pitch zone rate, first pitches that are in the zone, 59%. That is the 21st highest rate across MLB, a 90th percentile rate. He gets challenged on the plate all the time, first pitch. Why? Because Alejandro Kirk's first pitch swing rate this year, 13.5%, the 11th lowest across MLB. We are talking like nearly 87% of the time, Alejandro Kirk takes the first pitch of a plate appearance, a first percentile rate in MLB. Teams are going to notice that, and teams have noticed that. So Alejandro Kirk is behind 0-1 in nearly 60% of his plate appearances. And it's like a credit to him that he's still walking more than he's striking out this year, despite being behind so often. I mean, like, that's just how good his strike zone management is, and that's how good his bat to ball skills are. But I do wonder if he was more aggressive on the first pitch of the plate appearance, maybe he could do some more damage on those pitches, and maybe he could help get himself out of this thing. But I also am here for the argument that is actually part and parcel to his approach, that he needs to be taking a lot of pitches and getting deep into counts and seeing those walks, that's actually when he's at his best.
Well, he was great last year. He was great in 2021. I mean, this is a hitter the Jays should expect some good things from. But, you know, broadly, the bench at this point is an area that I think as the Blue Jays move ahead, they are going to have to look at upgrades. And I know it's only May. It's obviously ahead of the point that we're really deep into trade deadline talk. But, you know, this is an area internally the Blue Jays are already discussing and preparing for, as you would expect. The trade deadline, that is. And, you know, I think the bench, barring improvements, will have to be an area that they look to address. The bullpen, too. I mean, I don't know what kind of big picture thoughts you have on the bullpen here, Arden, but that's an area where every team needs to be exploring upgrades in the months leading up to that trade deadline.
Even before we saw the performance of the bullpen and the bench in 2023, I think in spring training, we could have told you, you know what the Blue Jays are going to be looking for at the trade deadline? They're going to be looking to upgrade their bench and their bullpen. Yep. Because that's what every good team is looking to do at the trade deadline. And if you are motivated to do that, you'll be able to do that at the trade deadline. So I have no doubt. Do you think Ernie Clement deserves a big league shot at some point right now? Is that what you're saying? Is that the Blue Jays should swap in Clement for Biggio on their bench? Ernie Clement, 935 OPS with the Buffalo Bisons over 31 games.
Well, I do know that Kevin Biggio is striking out at a career high rate. That's about 40%. I do know it's not looking good.
Clement's strikeout to walk, he has 4 Ks, 14 walks with Buffalo. What? He's on the heater of all heaters right now.
Are these bleeders that are falling in? Are these lasers?
He's doing something right.
He's not on the 40-man, so you'd also have to look into if you can get a 40-man spot. But I wouldn't be opposed, if I was the Blue Jays, to putting Biggio on the IL, getting him to a AAA rehab assignment, letting him work some things out in that setting and finding a 40-man spot for someone like Ernie Clement or Spencer Horowitz, who's already on the 40-man and also has a 900 OPS. Horowitz is probably the guy I would go to first. But again, I haven't looked at what the, you know, what the advanced metrics say about what kind of quality of contact they're making.
Yeah, the Horowitz would be a tougher fit just positionally, at least with Clement. Like, it's like you play anywhere on the infield.
Unless you need someone for Vlad, in which case Horowitz is a very easy fit.
No, yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, well, we will pick it up after the break here with more discussion about struggling Blue Jays, in this case, Alek Manoah. Welcome back to At the Letters. And before we get to Alek Manoah, which we will certainly want to discuss and get into some detail on, let's go behind the scenes a little bit. We said going into the season, we would do that periodically and discuss some of the stuff that goes into a major league season. For the Blue Jays, when they travel, they are flying charter. They are flying immediately after a game ends and getting to the next city as quickly as possible to sort of settle in. Arden, for you, for me, the travel looks a lot different. So let's take a moment here to touch on some of the best practices, some of the road city routines, tips and tricks. The last time the Blue Jays were on the road, you were on all three legs of that trip, Boston, Pittsburgh, and Philly. I think we're both on the next trip or part of the next trip that the Jays are on. It's something that, you know, it certainly requires a certain amount of planning. You're a pretty thoughtful person with respect to these things, so I'm sure you have some thoughts and tricks, and I'd be curious to hear them.
Yeah, no tricks. I mean, you said the word routine. Like, that's what that's my life, man, is habits and routines. So, I'm very boring and mundane person, so I just kind of get up and try to do the exact same thing every day.
Which is?
So, on the road, it would be get up, meditate, coffee shop, drink a ton of coffee, do a bunch of work, back to the hotel, gym for, I don't know, an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, get some food, more coffee, get dressed, more work, to the ballpark, and then the day the ballpark begins.
That sounds pretty productive and pretty caffeinated.
That's just what I just do that every day. I'm a very mundane person. It's very boring. There's nothing interesting. There's no vagabond sports writer thing, this weird idea that people have of what we do. Like, I'm just very uninteresting and monotonous and boring, and I just do the same stuff every single day.
And I think that, yeah, people maybe have the idea that it's like a party every night and that, you know, there's like this wild one bar after the other experience, which, like, you know, at times I've certainly indulged in that. But I think the reality sometimes doesn't allow for that. These jobs are pretty demanding and you want to be pretty prepared. I'm sure that would be tough to sustain otherwise.
Yeah, I just like to put myself in the best possible position to be successful. I like to be as prepared as possible. I don't like to cut corners. Like, I take my job really seriously, right? So, I do the same things every day, and I try to be, you know, at my best physically and mentally, because it can be demanding traveling and working the way that we do. But I love this job and I want to do it for as long as possible. So I want to do as good of a job as possible at it.
Yeah. Makes sense. For me, like, a couple, I don't know if you'd call them tips or tricks, but like, I always try to pack carry on only. I try to never check a bag, even if I'm going to spring for, like, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks, I really try to just do carry on because, you know, as you say, these days are pretty busy. And when you're on the road, the demands are pretty high. So I do not want to be spending time waiting for a check bag. I do not want to have to go and buy luggage or buy clothes to replace luggage that was lost. I want to have everything there with me. So that would be one thing. Nexus is obviously key for people who travel as often as we do. You end up skipping lines, which is awesome. Get a little pre-check here and there. That would be something. I think also I try to sleep like as much as I can, which can be challenging on the day of a travel assignment because oftentimes you're waking up pretty early to make a flight. But the next couple of days, once you're settling into a city, I try to like actually sleep as much as I can, which can be tough because, you know, as I'm sure you can relate to, you know, you get back to a hotel after being in whatever it is, Yankee Stadium, Kauffman Stadium, whatever the case, you're around thousands of people who are pretty amped up. You're around players who are, you know, pretty amped up after they perform. It can be kind of hard to wind down, but I guess that's part of the challenge, is sort of finding ways to do that and then rest up.
Yeah, the thing with sleep is having really consistent like times that you go to bed and wake up every day. And it's really hard to do that on a road trip because the games are at different times. Some games are longer than others. Sometimes you got to wake up early for a flight and stuff like that. So I you'd never sleep well on the road. But I'm like, my body just gets me up typically like 5:30 every day regardless. And I just start doing things. Like there's no benefit to me of doing the whole lie in bed, toss and turn, try to get back to sleep. Like I just get up and start. And that just means I can just prepare better for the broadcast. I can look up more stuff every morning before, the broadcast. I'm like sending, producers like a big long email of ideas and things that I might want to do. I like to be as prepared as possible. And that's the way I do it.
5:30 AM.
Every day.
Wow. I'm glad I'm able to sleep a little longer than that. But yeah, we can leave that there. That's a little look behind the scenes. We'll pick that up more as we continue here through the season. But, more importantly for the Blue Jays here, Alek Manoah. I mean, it's just been such a challenging year for him. It has been a season where his command has totally betrayed him. He has not been able to put the ball over the plate with any kind of consistency. You look at the numbers, 45 innings pitched. He's walked 36 hitters. He's also 32 hitters, excuse me. He's also hit four batters. So it's just free pass after free pass in a way that is absolutely not sustainable at the big league level as a starting pitcher. The last time he pitched, he threw more balls than strikes. That, again, not sustainable as a major league starting pitcher. So I don't know exactly where the Blue Jays go from here, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, the command has just been if you're looking for a root issue, and it's not just one thing, right? But like if you're looking at for one broad stroke, it's command. That's been the issue for him this year, and it degraded in a fairly severe way in his most recent outing, as you touched on. And you just even look at the greater season as a whole. Alek Manoah has thrown a first pitch ball to 44% of the batters he's faced. That's something that needs to be addressed. He's working from behind far too often. It's kind of interesting, actually, that Jose Berrios and Yusei Kikuchi are right up there with him in terms of starting batters with a first pitch ball really often. Like Kikuchi and Berrios are at 45%. All three of those Blue Jays starters are top 10 across baseball. It's not something you want. But here's the thing, like Berrios and Kikuchi are working their way back into counts. They're locating after that. They're getting back to 1-1, but Alek Manoah is often going to 2-0. He's gone 2-0 to nearly a fifth of the batters he's faced this year. It's the 10th most in MLB. Right now, Alek Manoah is running a higher walk rate than Yusei Kikuchi did last season as a starter. And Yusei Kikuchi was removed from the rotation. And Alek Manoah's outings right now are having a similar impact on the 2023 Blue Jays as Kikuchi's did on the 2022 Blue Jays, right? As the Blue Jays are facing early deficits in games that he starts. Hitters are logging very long defensive innings on their feet, then coming back to the dugout to try to claw back into games. The bullpen is regularly being asked to get a dozen outs or more. Like there are knock-on effects from this. So the Blue Jays absolutely need to find some solutions and corrections for Alek Manoah so that he can perform more to the standard that he set for himself last year going forward.
It's getting to the point that you almost want to have, almost need to have someone like Mitch White available behind Alek Manoah on days he starts, because we're seeing this now often enough that, if he doesn't have his command and he's going 2-3 innings, maybe he's allowed 3 runs, he's got a couple runners on base. Well, if it's one of those days, you're probably not assuming that he is simply going to find his command that day. In 2022, in 2021, maybe he struggles for a few innings, maybe he refines his command. This year, you're probably not making that assumption. So if you're in that position, you're down a few runs, that's where you need to have someone up. Now, it's probably Trevor Richards or Nate Pearson. I don't know how long you can do that, because every single time you have to go to your bullpen early, that ends up putting a toll on the relievers. And I think someone like Mitch White could be a pretty good piggyback option. I think we're getting to the point that you almost need to roster a second player around Manoah to have a piggyback insurance policy on days he pitches.
It's pretty incredible to be saying things like this, you know, eight starts, nine starts into like a defending AL Cy Young finalist season.
That was a strikeout. That's the fifth strikeout for Manoah. That's significant. That gives him 300 strikeouts for his career. And this is his 50th career start. A tremendous beginning to his young pitching career. He has struck out.
Right. And young in his career, too. Someone who you would assume would be on an upward trajectory and not, like, I think that a lot of projection systems thought that Alek Manoah would regress this year from the way that he performed in 2022, but not to this extent. And look, the slider issues are obvious and well documented. It's been a bit slower, as everything has in his repertoire. There's been less horizontal movement on his slider. He's been missing too far with it off the plate or too fat with it on the plate. So it's getting hammered when it's on the plate. But an even bigger issue, honestly, is just that he's getting fewer swings on it and less chase and fewer outs with it when it's off the plate and to the edges. We don't talk as much about this element, but his sinker command to right-handed hitters has also been really poor. You look at his sinkers to right-handed hitters, look at that heat map, just a bright red dot right over the heart of the plate. And last year, those sinkers to righties were front hip. They were right on the inside black. And now they are right over the heart of the plate. And you can look at the expected numbers against his sinker for righties. And he's actually honestly gotten away with it a lot this year. Like, things honestly could have been worse for Alek Manoah in a lot of his outings. I go back to that outing at Fenway Park that I was at on the last trip. Justin Turner, Kike Hernandez, they each made two outs against Manoah's two-seamer that had expected batting averages over 400. So that's two right-handed hitters making four outs on poorly located sinkers with XBAs over 400. So it's a problem.
Oh, yeah. It could be worse than what it has been so far. You're talking about a pitcher whose fastball is not as fast, whose slider is not sliding as much, whose command is not there, whose mechanics are off. It's just, there's nothing good. There's no silver lining. You know, it's not like there has been, oh my goodness, like every single ball in play is just finding a hole the way maybe it was with Kevin Gausman last year, and he was getting BABIPed and okay, there's a turnaround coming. Here, the stuff is worse. The command is worse. I just, like, you know, mechanically, early in the season, he said it wasn't a mechanical issue. I think clearly there are mechanical issues happening here. Clearly, he is not as comfortable in his delivery. He is not finding the strike zone enough. Whatever is happening with his delivery, it is not allowing him to throw strikes with any kind of consistency. And you absolutely have to throw strikes as a major league starting pitcher. So, you know, that much is clear. Now it's a question of what do they do? I mean, do you see any solution here? Like, if you're the Jays, if you're Pete Walker and John Schneider and Ross Atkins, you can let him keep going. You can let him keep going with a piggyback like a Mitch White. You can fake IL him. You can option him. Like, what do you do?
Those are your options, right? Like, there's nothing else. And like, I'm not a pitching coach, so I don't know what the mechanical tweak is for Manoah. I do know that I often see him on the mound kicking at his landing spot, and you often see him sort of like turning his shoulders after a pitch. It looks like he's trying to remind himself of cues in his delivery. I know that Blue Jays have been working hard on this with Manoah during side sessions. When we were in Philly on the off day, he was in with Pete Walker on the off day before his start, working on this stuff. Like, seldom do you see a starting pitcher day before a start on an off day at the ballpark working on this stuff. So Alek Manoah is doing everything that he can to get back to who he was. He doesn't want to fail. Like, and he is not someone who does not work hard and does not have a foundation of good routines. Just the velo being down this year, maybe there's something, and this isn't for this year, but even for next season, that can be done differently with his throwing program, whether in the off season or during spring training with his buildup. Like, I do wonder if there's some lessons to be learned there about what Alek Manoah does over the winter, about how he prepares for a season that can help him not be dealing with diminished velocity going into a campaign, because clearly, like, that's hurting him. But as far as like the slider command and location on his pitches. Like that's going to be something that Jeff Ware and Pete Walker and, you know, they're going to have to figure that stuff out. I don't think that switching up his catcher is going to have much of a tangible difference. Like, that's just kind of throwing something at the wall, yeah. Right? Like, could we see Danny Jansen catch him at some point just to try it out? Sure. Why not? To give him a different look. But, like, how is that going to impact his slider command? Like, how is that going to help him with these inconsistencies? The problem doesn't seem to be pitch selection or, like, the way the pitch is received. It seems to be how the pitch is being thrown.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, I don't know how to solve that in season. I imagine that is a difficult thing to solve in season. We are talking about diminished stuff and diminished command. That's not something that is easy to flip a switch and turn around. What we do know is that Alek Manoah is a year removed from being a Cy Young finalist. This is someone who, not only for one season, but for two seasons, was an elite starting pitcher in the major leagues. So that is very tough to do. He obviously has some skills and some experiences that can help him get back to that point in theory. And yet he does not seem close to getting back to that right now.
Agreed.
All right, well, let's leave it there this week for At the Letters. We will be back next week with a lot more Blue Jays news to discuss. We'll see where the rest of this Yankee series leads. And, of course, the Orioles and Rays coming up after that. In the meantime, thanks for listening to At the Letters, which has been produced by Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. Thanks for listening to ATL, wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to Arden. I'm Ben, and we will talk to you soon.